This is a 720 to go podcast from Chicago's WGN Radio 720.
This podcast is sponsored by ADM.
As one of the world's largest agricultural processors, ADM is uniquely positioned to serve the world's growing needs for abundant food and renewable energy. ADM.
When it comes to the business of America's farmland, you need the information from the people who know it best. That's why we bring you AgriCast with Orion Samuelson and Max Armstrong.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to the Saturday Morning Show. Orion Samuelson back with you, and I want to begin by saying thank you to Max Armstrong for doing all of the chores while Gloria and I were cruising in a very interesting part of the world for the past 2 weeks. Flying with a group of great WGN listeners to Hong Kong, boarding the cruise ship, the Crystal Symphony, and then cruising to a port in China, two ports in Vietnam, a port in Cambodia, a port in Thailand, finally docking in Singapore, and then taking the long ride back to Chicago. Somebody said, well, how long was that plane ride back to Chicago from Singapore? 4 hours from Singapore to Hong Kong, an hour and a half on the ground layover, and then 15 hours from Hong Kong to Chicago. But the stops along the way, fascinating. I had been to all of the countries except Cambodia, had never been there. But I found Vietnam the most fascinating on the trip because I was there in 1998 with a trade mission hosted by the U.S. Grains Council. And it was interesting to see the changes that have taken place in Vietnam, not only from a commerce standpoint and a building standpoint, but also from an attitude standpoint. Because if you are under 40 years of age, you have no memory of the war that involved the United States in Vietnam. When I was there in 98, there was some resentment about Americans and no outright hatred at that point, but certainly not as trusting as they should be, and there was concern about Americans in Vietnam. That's not the case anymore. As a matter of fact, they no longer call it the American War, at least those that I talk to. They call it the Vietnamese Civil War, the Communist North against the Democratic South. And so they refer to it as the Civil War of Vietnam, North against the South. And while the North was victorious and we had to leave, and they changed the name of Saigon, the city in the southern part of the country, to Ho Chi Minh City, now they're beginning to refer to it again as Saigon, and I'm guessing that it will eventually be called Saigon once again. But all in all, thanks to Kelly Cruises, to Nancy Kelly, who accompanies us on the trip, and certainly thanks to the WGN listeners who joined us on the trip for an interesting education and an opportunity again to realize how fortunate we are to live in America with all of the blessings that we have. Well, we have several people to visit with this morning, and oh, congratulations to FFA members in our audience. We're coming to the end of National FFA Week and all of the great work that FFA members do in their communities. We salute you for that. Our first guest this morning is a lady I've known since she was 9 years old. You'll learn more about that story. She's currently the head of the Department of Rural Development for USDA here in Illinois, Colleen Callahan Burns, and she'll be joining us when we continue here on the Saturday Morning Show. Exhibitor of the Grand Champion Barrow at the International Livestock Show when she was 9 years old, the first ever lady president of the National Association of Farm Broadcasting, and now the Illinois Director of the Rural Development Agency at USDA. I'm talking about Colleen Callahan Burns, who I've known since you were nine.
9 years old, that's right, 1960. That's
right. And you're continuing the great work you did as a farm broadcaster by now involving yourself with people and communities through my favorite agency at the Department of Agriculture, because you have been able to bring much needed facilities into rural communities and help redevelop them. So again, for those that are not familiar with what the agency does, quick background.
It's one of the 17 USDA agencies, and for a long time probably was one of the lesser known. That's not the case any longer. We are a lender. We have loans and grants that are designed specifically to meet the needs and benefits of rural communities. So whether it is in housing, or whether it is a business that may need some financial assistance through a loan or a grant, whether it's a community or a rural water district that needs to improve their water infrastructure, or whether it is that community that needs a hospital or a clinic or a storm siren, it's often said that USDA Rural Development could build a community from the ground up, and indeed we have, because in the Midwest, when we have tornadoes go through and a community literally needs to be rebuilt from the ground up, all of those programs sometimes are utilized.
You said you're a lender, but you also provide grants beyond loans?
Absolutely.
Explain the difference.
The grants, of course, are funding that are grants. They are granted and they don't need to be paid back.
Right.
A loan, of course, is just that, and as a lender, we expect to be paid back. Sure. So we look at the financials just as any other lending institution would. We expect to be paid back, so we look for those good loans. But in a guarantee, sometimes we are partnering with the local lender, the bank. We don't compete, we become a partner. So let's say in a rural community there is a business that needs to buy a new piece of equipment, and they go into the bank and they say, I need this new piece of equipment, I've got the demand, but I can't keep up with supply. And the bank may say, you know what, I've known you since you were a little kid and we believe in you, but it's a little risky right now. If we can get USDA Rural Development to guarantee this loan, absolutely. So we'll look at the same financials. If we guarantee that loan, say at 80%, it helps the bank because our smaller rural banks have lending limits.
Right.
And that means that they only have to put that 20% on their books. They still have that money to share throughout the community. So it benefits the bank for us to be their partner. But it also benefits their client because the bank typically extends the life of the loan, and they also usually lower the interest rate. So there are many ways that we can help bring job creation to rural communities through supporting a rural business.
And while you're the Illinois director, the programs you're talking about apply all across the
nation. All across the United States, a $206 billion portfolio for rural development. In Illinois specifically, a year ago, we were able to invest over $600 million throughout rural Illinois. That turns out to be, on average, about $1.7 million every day, whether it is in housing or community facilities or water or business. And we're pretty efficient because when I started in 2009, we had 125 employees in Illinois. We now have 94, and we're still meeting the mission. So as I oftentimes say, leadership changes. It changes at the local level and at the state level and certainly at the national level. But the one thing that doesn't is the mission of USDA Rural Development. And so currently in Illinois, an administrative cost of 1.5 cents per dollar delivered is a pretty good percentage.
So give me two or three examples of things you've done in Illinois.
I would say that when you look at, let's start with housing. You know, Orion farmers don't have retirement in their vocabulary.
Right.
Yet they are very proud of their hometown, but they are also reluctant to move into that hometown from their farm. And so when that situation presents itself, where do they move to? Likely there is just another great big old house in town like the one that they're leaving on the farm, and they need something more modest in size. So our programs can assist a community in helping build senior housing, or maybe assisted living, or apartments. And without that funding, those needs go unmet. And oftentimes people leave a community not because they want to, but because they have to.
Have you funded any hospitals?
We have many hospitals, many critical access hospitals. And we can do that directly through our community facilities loan program. But another opportunity to work in that very space is through the rural electric cooperatives, through a program where the rural electric co-op becomes our client. They establish a revolving loan fund with the funds that they receive at 0% interest for 10 years. They have to pay that money back, of course. But in the revolving loan fund, as they choose then to relend that money, say, to the hospital that needs to expand or build, they set the loan terms, they set the life of the loan, and then as that loan is paid back, then that's how the USDA Rural Development gets their funding back. So there are many ways, beyond what one might expect, that we help grow America, rural America, by helping bolster the economy.
Final question. Some people say if it's government, there probably is 300 pages of paperwork. How does a community or a business apply, and is it pretty tough?
The beginning of the process, of course, is to establish a relationship, and I view that as my responsibility. And I thank you today for giving me the opportunity to explain what USDA Rural Development is, how it works, because the more people that know about our programs, the more individuals, the more businesses, and the more communities we can help. And you can, if you have access, go to USDA.gov. That will then take you to a state where you can click, and then to all of the different programs, and then all of the different office locations and contact information. So that's one way to start that process. The other way is for us, and again, it's our responsibility, because when I started, I have to confess, I didn't know a lot about rural development, and I didn't know much about the programs. And so that's my responsibility to share that information. What you do every day is inform and educate over a broad variety of topics. I still get to do that. I get to inform and educate, but about USDA Rural Development.
Right. So start at the local office.
And when you ask about, yes, starting at the local office, and is it a cumbersome process, it's important to note that in the 2014 Farm Bill, the Food, Farms, and Jobs Act, that there is a part of that that streamlined these processes. As an example, when the tornado went through Gifford and Washington, Illinois, nearly a year ago, USDA Rural Development streamlined its emergency process. And so Gifford, Illinois was the first in the United States to use this new streamlined process. So we were able to meet with them. We were able to get that application processed. And that water treatment plant that was destroyed is nearly back online 1 year later. So we're trying. It can be cumbersome, but we know that. And we're trying to make the process easier to use.
Our visit with Colleen Callahan-Burns, the director of the Rural Development Agency with the U.S. Department of Agriculture, right here in Illinois. Coming up next on the Saturday Morning Show, we'll talk about a celebration of agriculture coming up in the month of March. That coming when we continue here on the Saturday Morning Show. Barry Nelson is manager media relations for the John Deere Company, but he also wears a few other hats, including one, Barry, that involves Ag Day. Here we are, 2015. Tell me when and where and what.
Well, every year, I'm with a group called the Ag Council of America, and we have a board that plans National Ag Day. And this year, it's been scheduled for March 18th in Washington, D.C., and it actually starts out with a reception, kind of a panel discussion reception the night before with AgriPulse. You may have heard of that group. That way everybody kind of gets to town, gets settled in, and then the next day we have different activities to promote agriculture, culminating in a very nice dinner, which you're the MC at every year and do a great job. And a lot of years we get the Secretary of Agriculture or a lot of our leaders that attend that, and it's just a time to really focus on the importance of agriculture in the United States.
And you do spend time with young people. There are quite a few young people that come to town. What's their purpose?
Right, we have FFA kids, AFA, which is college version of FFA. These kids come in, they're making hill visits, so they learn how to be talking to their representatives and how to lobby on behalf of agriculture. They get to participate in a lot of the activities at National Ag Day. We have a student essay contest, and whoever wins that contest, we have them come up and read their essay. Have a video contest, and we even have an art contest. So we're in the process right now of being on the board. We're judges, so we're judging all these things as they come in now.
And the whole purpose is to let the world know that agriculture not only feeds us, but does a great deal more.
Absolutely. When you consider there's going to be over 9 billion people in the world by 2045 is what they're saying now, and that's not too far away, we have to be able to produce food, basically have to probably produce about twice as much as what we have now on about the same amount of land and less water. So we have some real issues there. And actually that goes back to a lot of the technology we're putting on machinery nowadays to help farmers become more efficient in how they're producing crops or livestock.
Now, for people who want to attend March 18th, what should they do now?
They can go to agday.org, and there's all sorts of information, because not only do we celebrate National Ag Day in Washington, D.C., but a lot of local communities have their own Ag Day or Ag Week just to support the farmers in their area and, again, the importance of agriculture.
Barry Nelson. Barry is the chief media relations person for Deere & Company, and very active in putting together the Ag Day celebration in our nation's capital. And again, more information can be found at agday.org. And we'll be there once again to serve as MC for the luncheon, and then also serve as the MC for the banquet in the patio area of the U.S. Department of Agriculture on the evening of March 18. If you are planning a trip to Washington and you're involved in agriculture, or if you're not involved in agriculture but would like to participate, particularly in the banquet, you'll find all that information at agday.org. And we'd love to see you there. We had a packed patio last year for the dinner. Dinner is always prepared from pork that comes from the National Pork Producers Council. And it really is a great opportunity to let people in our nation's capital and across the country know about the importance of agriculture. And also to learn about how complicated agriculture can be sometime, because I've mentioned several times this week that if you're a livestock producer or a grain producer in the United States, you have a challenge with the marketplace, you have a challenge with weather, but now, since we're global, you also have a challenge with activities that happen outside the border of the United States, but that have an impact on prices. The port strike on the West Coast that has finally been settled created real problems for exporters of agricultural products. When I was cruising in Asia and had the opportunity to talk to people in the importing business, particularly in the restaurant business, they said they couldn't get American beef by ship, which they normally did. Some of the high-end restaurants that want to serve American beef then turn to air cargo, which is very costly. But that had an impact. I think it cost us some market share in the meat market and also in the grain market in some of those buyers in Asia. And then the other thing happening outside the borders that so far benefited soybean growers in this country, the trucker strike in Brazil. That's having a tremendous impact on the economy of Brazil, but it's also made it very difficult to export Brazilian soybeans just when they are being harvested and coming into the world marketplace. But it goes beyond that, as I learned from Dr. Michael Cordonier, whose website, Soybean and Corn Advisor, pointed out some interesting things, that the arrival of grain and soybean meal at the ports of Santos and Paranagua have been greatly reduced. But it goes beyond that. The Fiat assembly plant in one of the states of Brazil had to close down because they couldn't get parts. 6,000 workers were sent home. And then the giant JBS meat processor closed 8 processing facilities for poultry, swine, and beef due to lack of animals. Couldn't get them there. Farmers are dumping milk because milk haulers are on strike and they weren't able to get milk picked up. Dairy processors are shutting down due to a lack of milk. Soybean crushers in Brazil closing down due to a lack of soybeans. Feed mills closing down to a lack of corn and soybean meal shipments. Hogs and poultry operations out of feed and no way to obtain more. And according to Dr. Michael Cordonnier, the list goes on and on. So not only is it pushing our bean prices higher, it's creating real problems for producers and processors in Brazil. Good morning again, and welcome to part two of the Saturday Morning Show. Orion Samuelson with you. Max Armstrong is in Phoenix, Arizona this weekend. He's attending the annual Commodity Classic that brings together producers of corn and soybeans and wheat and grain sorghum. They do this once a year, hold their annual individual meetings, and then get together to talk about issues and concerns that affect all grain and oilseed producers here in the United States. So Max will have something to say about that, I'm sure, next week. But right now, as we get ready to talk markets, Max will be doing that with Brian Basting, and then we're also going to talk about National FFA Week coming to an end today. But before all of that, welcome to Samuelson Says, sponsored by Wink Products Company, makers of quality specialty cleaning products since 1947. I'm Orion Samuelson with a reminder, it's clock-changing time again.
Samuelson Says, the views and commentary of Orion Samuelson.
Well, if you're tired of your clothing being ruined by a spill or a stain, now there's hope. Thanks to Wink Wash Away Laundry Stain Remover. This easy and safe-to-use wash stain remover is a must-have in the laundry room for all washable, color-fast fabrics, including wool, cotton, synthetics, and even cashmere. And for those unexpected stains when you're on the go, watch them vanish with Wink Instant Spot Remover. Check them out today at www.wink.com. That's WHINK.com.
Now, with this week's Samuelson Says, here's Orion.
If you're a regular listener of Samuelson Says, you know that for the past couple of decades, I've been waging a one-person campaign against this spring-forward, fall-back routine that we go through twice a year in 48 of our 50 states. Hawaii and Arizona do not make the change to daylight saving time in the spring back to standard time in the fall, but all of the other states do. And I keep asking the question, why do we do this twice a year? And I advocate picking one or the other, making it daylight saving time 12 months of the year or standard time 12 months of the year. I know that clocks, for the most part today, reset themselves, but still, why do we do it? Well, maybe I'm getting a little more support because a bill has been introduced into the Washington State Legislature considering end to daylight saving time. Five other states, including Oregon, considering similar action. And according to Capital Ag Press, Washington State Legislator Elizabeth Scott, a supporter of the bill, said, "What I'm suggesting is that we save time by simplifying our lives." And then she came up with this. I'm not sure where the research is on this, but she also said it would reduce heart attacks, car wrecks, and work accidents found to increase with the sleep schedule disruptions. She concluded with this argument for her Washington State constituents. She said, "Wouldn't it be nice to have the 4th of July fireworks start before 10 o'clock at night?" On the other hand, supporters of daylight saving time said they like late summer sunsets. The Golf Association of Utah said unplayed rounds at golf courses because of earlier nightfall would result in a loss of $24 million in income for golf courses. Well, whatever you like, let's pick one or the other and get away from this business of setting clocks twice a year. That's all I'm asking. Pick one or the other. And remember, people talk about adding an hour of daylight with saving time. Doesn't work that way. It's like cutting a foot off the bottom of the blanket and sewing it on the top of the blanket to make the blanket longer. Doesn't work. And daylight saving time does not create any more sunlight. My thoughts on Samuelson Says.
Samuelson Says comes to you each week on this station. Samuelson Says is a presentation of the Tribune Radio Network.
Oh, yes, the old daylight saving time issue. It'll probably never change, but I keep talking about it. We're going to talk markets. Max Armstrong standing by with a special market guest, and that happens when we continue on the Saturday Morning Show.
Brian Basting joining us in the studio from Advanced Trading. This winter, as we take a look at marketing opportunities for farmers, what are you seeing out there? What kinds of things strike you about this market right now, Brian?
I think it's a market that's looking at South America, Max, and trying to figure out how much of a reduction in the acreage or reduction in the crop size we're going to see, particularly in soybeans. It's still going to be a record crop. Don't want to give the impression it's going to be a dramatic decline by any means, but maybe not as quite as large as what we were expecting earlier. The key thing we're watching now is this double crop corn acreage in Brazil. That's the corn they plant after the soybean harvest. It's late this year because the soybean harvest is a little bit late, so that may push it back further into the spring. And what we've seen the last couple of years is the rainy season in Brazil has been extended, and that's helped their yields. If the rainy season stops at a normal time this year, maybe those yields won't be quite as good.
What is leading you to think that soybean crop in South America could be smaller? I mean, private estimates I've seen in recent days are hanging in there pretty well just about where they've been over the last month or so.
Just maybe a less than ideal finish to the growing season, a little bit of dryness here, a little bit of wetness in different areas of the country. Again, don't want to give the impression at all that it's a substantial decline, but maybe just the top end taken off of the crop.
I remember a couple of months ago having a conversation with someone pondering what the dispute would be, the disruption would be at harvest time in South America. Because I remember being down there in Argentina a few years back. There were strikes in the streets. I don't even know what the protest was about, but it halted things. You usually find something going on at an export elevator in Brazil. I remember one year there was a conveyor fire that disrupted exports for a while out of the port of Paranaguá. And this winter, a trucker's strike. Put it in perspective for us.
It's important that the logistics for Brazil are lined up this time of year because it gets very busy with the harvest. So any type of short-term disruption may open a window of export opportunity for the U.S. However, I think typically these things only last a short period of time. And once they get resolved, the export logistics get lined up, and you start to see the U.S. business drop off. And we expect that to happen probably about the middle of March, toward the end of March this year. We're already starting to see the liftings drop off substantially from what they were last fall.
You do sometimes see a spike in the market, a little bit of an upward move in the soybean price when these things happen, don't we?
Occasionally. I think that we've seen a lot of volatility in the soybean market the last week to 10 days here. 10 days or 10 cents up one day, 10 cents down the next day, 15 cents up the next day. So, yeah, I think that I would view that, though, as probably more of an opportunity as opposed to a dramatic change in trend, at least at this point.
Yeah, as you point out, these things, when they do occur in South America, are usually pretty short in duration.
They are. And I think typically the logistics are, once they get lined up and the crop starts to work its way into the pipeline, definitely you're looking at export business shifting from U.S. to South America.
I saw an interesting statistic the other day, and I guess I really hadn't thought about it that much, but now on trips when I've been in South America, it is very noticeable how little on-farm storage you see there. And I believe it was in reference specifically to the Brazilian state of Mato Grosso. They said that only 15% of the crop can be stored on the farm, they really are dependent upon transportation at harvest time to get the crop away from the fields, to get it toward the elevators, to get it into the export channels. And that's why a trucker's strike was so critical.
It is. I don't want to diminish that by any means because it does cause some short-term disruption in terms of the movement of the newly harvested crop, as you mentioned. It takes a while to get that movement to the port area and get those bushels into the pipeline as such. But typically, and you look at the past history of these events, they don't last a long period of time. There's always exceptions. You never know. But for the time being, particularly from an economic standpoint, the source of cheapest origin of beans in the world is South America.
Is anybody talking U.S. weather markets yet for this summer ahead? And I ask you simply because there are places in the Corn Belt where there has not been much winter moisture, to be sure. There have been other places, southern Corn Belt, where they've had plenty, and on down into the south where they piled up one snow after another. But looking at some of the extended forecasts, some of the forecasters looking at this summer say we might see things just shut off pretty dramatically around the end of June or beginning of July.
Yeah, every year is different. I think this year obviously is a lot different than 2014 in terms of the winter. It will be different in the spring. It always is. I think anytime you move into that critical period, which you just described, late June, early July, it's really critical for the corn crop especially. And we've seen perfect conditions develop. For example, in 2014, really mild temperatures and some ample moisture, and the result was a record yield. You don't have to turn the clock back very far to 2012, though. We had a really good-looking crop in 2012 all the way up until the third week in June, and we all know what happened after that with the hot temperatures. But in answer to your question, I have not heard a lot of people talking about that. Anytime you move into spring, though, we do need some moisture recharge in certain areas. We do need some timely moisture, so it'll be something to keep an eye on moving forward.
We've seen a lot of delayed planting springs, it seems, over the past decade, where we find temperatures are cool, there's plenty of moisture. Farmers seemingly have narrow windows of opportunity to get in to plant, but they get it planted. I mean, for all the hand-wringing that takes place, we get the crop planted, it seems. Might be shoving it back a little bit in some instances. But how do you view the planting season weather, and how markets react to it?
It's interesting. It's a bit of a double-edged sword because you're starting to see the last few years more producers maintain flexibility and wait, for example, to put on nitrogen until at planting time or after planting, as a matter of fact, which gives them more flexibility to make a decision on whether to plant corn or beans. The flip side to that is that the size of the equipment that producers have today, they can really put in a tremendous amount of acres in a short period of time. So they can be confronted with a weather challenge. They'll maybe hold them back for a couple days, but it's not devastating in terms of missing the ideal window to plant because they can get so much done in a short period of time.
Yeah, it's a great point. Of course, there's a key decision or two that producers have to make here about farm programs, about crop insurance, in addition to what they're going to put in the ground this spring. And I gather there's still a fair amount of acreage kind of in flux there between corn and beans. What are you thinking about here? What are the market factors that really come to mind that you're talking about on a daily basis with your growers?
I think that the trend that we're picking up is that soybeans definitely nudged their way into the rotation the last couple of years. The market dictated that, particularly last year when the soybeans were so attractive in terms of the returns per acre. I think that there was a window here last fall, maybe in the early stages of 2015, where beans still had a strong hand. I think that has been diminished a little bit the last 6 to 8 weeks here. Corn has worked its way back into the conversation a little bit more strongly here lately. I still think we're going to see a substantial amount of corn planted. I think maybe on the fringe areas, maybe up in the northern plains, and maybe in the south, for example. Maybe the higher input cost crops of corn and cotton, for example, may swing a few acres away from those crops into beans. But I don't get the feeling in the heart of the Midwest, Illinois, Indiana, Iowa, I don't get the feeling we're going to see a wholesale switch away.
USDA seemed to indicate in their outlook the other day that the outlook for them, that the corn yield, would not be as strong as it was in 2014. But they didn't bring it down too much, I guess, did they? What was your assessment of where USDA landed on that in a very preliminary look at the growing season?
Yeah, most people were in that mid-160 area. I think USDA was like 166.8, somewhere in that area. So I think, yeah, we really raised the bar in terms of what U.S. producer can do after 2014. Very exciting to see those yields. I think that's a good starting point. I think anytime you had perfect conditions like 2014, you got to view the next year with a little bit of caution in terms of a repeat. But we certainly saw the potential in 14, so I don't want to diminish the opportunity to do that again. But I think that probably the mid-160s is a good starting point.
Anything on the demand front that strikes you at the moment? Obviously, we're rebuilding livestock numbers.
That was one thing I did look at from the Ag Outlook Forum numbers, nearly a 13.8 billion bushel demand base forecast for 15-16 on corn. We need to continue to grow large crops. Same thing for soybeans, about a 3.8 billion bushel demand base. Again, those numbers can change too quite a bit, but looking at them at face value, we need to continue to grow large crops to meet that demand, and that sets up the potential for a lot of market volatility and opportunity here in the months ahead.
Oh, a lot of market volatility. Well, yes, it does bring opportunity, but boy, you have to stay on top of what's happening in the marketplace. And again, always keep in mind that there is a lot that can happen outside the borders of the United States that you also have to consider, such as the two events I mentioned earlier, the port strike and the trucker strike in Brazil. Always interesting to hear from Brian Basting with Advanced Trading, headquartered in Bloomington, Illinois. National FFA Week coming to an end today, and we'll talk about that when we continue here on the Saturday Morning Show. Every year, FFA members across the country observe National FFA Week, and as we wind down the month of February, we also wind down National FFA Week. I'm joined in the studio by two officers of the Illinois FFA, Cody Morris, who is the state president, and Andrew Klein, who is the state reporter, making the trip to Chicago for, well, National FFA Week, but also a special presentation. So lean in here, if you would, Andrew, and tell me why you were here in Chicago.
Well, actually, yes. Yesterday, Orion, we had the special privilege of attending John Marshall High School, where Glenn Stith, a private donor, donated some FFA jackets and some significant funds to that chapter to help purchase FFA jackets for those kids. So we got to see Miss William and a bunch of local representatives and dignitaries at the jacket presentation. A lot of the freshman class came down and watched, and it was really just awesome to see those kids get those jackets.
Were they truly excited?
They really were, and they already had the jackets on when we showed up, so a lot of them were strutting around the high school in their official dress and looking good, and it was just really cool to see them experience that, and it was good to be there.
The blue jacket is still a part of the dress code for FFA, is it not?
Actually, it most certainly is. The blue corduroy jacket has been a part of a FFA official dress for a very long time. It's a proud tradition of Illinois FFA and National FFA, and we're happy that the kids at John Marshall got to experience it.
I have to tell you, when I grew up on the farm in Wisconsin and was a member of the FFA, we couldn't afford a jacket. And I mentioned that on the air after I became a farm broadcaster and was here at WGN. And a lady listener heard that, and she said, well, you've got to have an FFA jacket. And she made one for me. So I finally, after all these years, have an FFA jacket. Andrew, tell me about your FFA and farming career. What are you doing?
Well, actually, my agriculture experience stems from my dad's business, and he's a rural arborist, so I do a lot of tree cutting with him. And that's the side of agriculture that I draw from, but I do currently live on a hobby farm where we keep a couple steers in the lot and got some chickens and goats. So it's enough to keep me busy and stay connected to agriculture, and then my future in agriculture will be in agricultural education.
You're going to be a teacher.
Yes, I am. Yes, I am. There's a dire need for teachers in this country, and I'm going to help fill that role.
Well, good for you, because I credit my VOAG teacher with changing my life and getting me into the farm broadcasting industry. So you can change people's lives, young man, so I compliment you for wanting to pursue that career.
Thank you very much.
So let's turn to the president, if you'll trade places, and let's get Cody Morris in here. You're going to have to get up a little closer to the microphone here in the studio, Cody. First of all, tell me about your FFA career.
Most definitely. Thank you a lot for the opportunity to talk to you, Orion. It's been one ride, that's for sure, throughout FFA. I grew up in Mattoon, graduated from there in 2013, and my projects were beef and sheep production. I raised Cordell sheep and Angus cattle.
And what are you doing now?
I am serving the Illinois FFA as the state president. Very honored to be with my teammates and traveling around the state of Illinois talking to members.
And did you have to interrupt an education career?
We did. We took the year out of school. So I'm more than happy to step away from the classroom and experience what we've experienced this year.
And where are you getting your education?
I was a freshman at Lakeland College last year, and I'm going to return back there.
Career plans?
Ag business and industry is what I plan to pursue.
There are at least 300 careers in the agribusiness community today, and a lot of people who are going to other schools and job hunting don't realize that agriculture is far beyond the farm and far beyond the ranch. So many other opportunities that they could really pursue. Give me an idea of how many chapters, how many members we have in the state of Illinois, and how active are they?
We're very proud to say that we have 325 FFA chapters in the state of Illinois, consisting of 17,500 FFA members, and that make up, 29,000 agriculture education students in the state of Illinois. And while we're proud of our FFA numbers, we're also proud of those students taking the agriculture education classes.
The thing, coming back to the career opportunities, we probably have the largest FFA chapter right here in Chicago, in the city, don't we?
We do. We're very proud of Chicago High School of Ag Sciences.
They have done a great deal. Now, from the standpoint of your career as an officer, do you have any thoughts of maybe running for national office?
It crosses your mind, but it's always enjoyable to sit back and think about Illinois. I've been more than honored to serve Illinois, and this is where we're from, and we're proud of our state.
Every week on our national television show, we salute an FFA chapter. And every chapter has an interesting story of community involvement. Can you give me some idea of the various activities chapters in Illinois carry out for the community?
Several times throughout this week, chapters are getting involved with the public and showing them what FFA is all about. Just recently, I visited Cuba High School, and they had an alumni luncheon and invited the public to come talk to the FFA members and eat the pork chops, and they had the opportunity to show off their chapter as well as their school.
Alumni associations are important for FFA, aren't they?
They are. They help out immensely, that's for sure.
Well, I want to thank you for making the visit to Chicago, not just to see us, but for the other activities. We've had the opportunity to visit with Cody Morris, who is state president of the Illinois FFA and his home chapter, Mattoon, Illinois. And Andrew Klein, I don't think I asked you what your chapter is.
Amboy,
Illinois. Anyway, continue to do the great work that you do.
Thank you, Orion, for everything you do.
This podcast is sponsored by ADM.
Orion Samuelson keeps you connected to the world of business and agriculture on WGN. Hear his reports weekday mornings, afternoons, and nights, and catch Orion and Max on Saturday mornings at 5 a.m., only on Chicago's WGN Radio 720.